Hi, I'm Tom. I write the Seriously Risky Business newsletter, and today I'm talking to independent cybersecurity researcher, the Gruk, about the Belarusian cyber partisans. As you'll hear, the group first emerged in 2019 to almost no fanfare, and in fact, their early campaigns fell flat. But its tactics have improved, and it could well be giving the Belarusian government some serious headaches. They've disrupted railways, infiltrated intelligence agencies, and stolen massive government databases and troves of Belarusian audio intercepts, including interior ministry intercepts from foreign embassies in Belarus. How did they evolve into an effective group? We think it's because they've independently reinvented how professional intelligence agencies do business. We talk about the cyber partisans and the intelligence cycle, which encompasses planning, collection, processing and exploitation, analysis and dissemination. Gruk and I discuss the cyber partisans and how the group is not only doing collection and exploitation, which is what everyone in cybersecurity focuses on, but how the group has more recently invested in analysis and dissemination, turning raw intelligence into something that will actually have impact. These efforts don't have much to do with hacking. Here's Gruk.
I believe they started in 2019 or 2020. Basically, they were a group of, I don't want to be mean and say nobodies, but they were just, you know, your web dev, your DevOps, your programmers, your students. They were just straightforward IT guys. And then when Lukashenko stole the election, they wanted to resist that in some way. And they had these IT skills, so they were like, well, let's become hackers. And they did, which is, you know, obviously somewhat amazing in itself. But they did their first operation sort of immediately, which was, I forget the details, but it caught a little bit of attention, but not as much as they thought. I mean, I think what speaks to the... one of the things I kind of love about these guys is they're very young and naive, and they basically thought that the first operation they did would topple the regime. And when it didn't, they were a little bit disappointed.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
They're like, you know, we've done it. That's it. But, you know, when that didn't work and then they suddenly realized they had to do this long term, it seems like their operational tempo was initially sort of like they did this one thing and then they went slow for almost a year. And I think that they were either doing more low-level stuff or they were tooling up or training or something like that. And then when they sort of they reemerged onto the scene, they had this very high operational tempo and they started doing not necessarily a lot of hacking operations, but a lot of release operations.
Right, yep.
Like one of the ways that they tooled up was they became very adept at how they handled the public relations side of yep. their hacking. Yep. And this is one of the things that they've said when I've spoken to them is that they sort of, they realize that, you know, if you have, say, 50 gigs of audio data and you dump all of it, you're going to get maybe one news story where people say, you know, 50 gigs of audio data dumped.
Yeah.
And then day two, it's gone because no one's going to sit and listen to it.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's just,
if you want to get...
Yeah, it's just intractable, isn't it? Like, it's too much to listen to.
Exactly. So they realized that if they wanted to get any leverage out of this, that they actually wanted to get the sort of maximum use out of it, what they needed to do was they needed to sort of pre-process it for people and then release chunks of it at a time. So, you know, I guess we can talk about that a bit later about how the process that they go through on that. But they understood that, you know, if they found 10 exciting stories those gigs and gigs of audio data, they had to take those 10 individual stories and release them separately.
Right. Yep.
And
yep.
that would get them 10 stories in the follow-up, which would be a lot more impactful than just this, you know, 50 gigs dumped. So
it also allows allows them to shape what story they're telling in a significant way. I guess something like WikiLeaks, people can dive in and they each bring their own agenda to what they would report on, whereas in this case, they still control the agenda. So before we started, we were talking, I mentioned the intelligence cycle, and I think that's, in the terms of this discussion, it's a useful way to think about what a group needs to do. And one of the functions is analysis and production and dissemination, and that's what they're doing. They've kind of recreated that portion of the intelligence cycle, which is sometimes or often forgotten when you've got groups like this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the entire other half of intelligence. You know, so everyone gets very excited about like the collection and, you know, the recruitment or the handling and all the stuff with the spies.
Especially in cyber operations, it's the 0 days and the, you know, the BGP hijacks that lead to this. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, none of that is of any use if it can't be used. Right. Mm-hmm. Like you can collect everything you want, but if it goes nowhere, it's not going to influence policy or decision making or strategy. So what's the point? Right. It has to be processed. Like it has to go through the analysts who know what they're doing. They have to process it into, you know, actual intelligence, and then it needs to be given to the people who can do something with it. Yeah. Like these are the critical steps. You can, if you have poor collection, but excellent analysis and dissemination, you will beat the snot out of someone who's got great collection but has no analysis or dissemination.
So that's what I think that's seriously risky business. Our collection's not that good, but our analysis is excellent.
It's a very important role, I think. And there's a reason that, you know, like the CIA, over half of it is analysts. Mm. And on the one hand, you might say it's because they're, you know, desk bound pencil pusher, you know, whatever. But I mean, if you contrast that with the KGB, at the end of the Soviet Union, the KGB had 12 analysts. 12.
That's like, astounding.
The CIA had like 10,000 or something, right? Like, there were more lunch ladies at Langley than analysts at KGB. That was the sort of Soviet thing where they loved the documents. Like, the documents said everything. You didn't need analysis. And I think we could say, like, the thing about the cyber partisans is that they learned, like, the documents are not enough. You need that analysis. And that was they learned how to be an intelligence, they learned the intelligence cycle from first principles.
Yep.
You know, like they
yeah. And I think that having a really clear goal is what helps you there, because you can measure what you're achieving. Yeah. And if you don't think you're achieving something, you've got to step back and say, why not? And what do we need to do to have that impact? But because, like, from that very first reporting I did about it, or writing I did about it, they had a lot of stuff, but like you said, there was no revolution.
Right. So I think you're right. It's, you know, they have mission, they've got purpose. And that's sort of one of the things that differentiates the professionals from the amateurs, right? If you look at, you know, why is NSA different from a random group of hackers? It's not necessarily all of the tooling, it's mission. Like NSA doesn't just hack a thing for hacking a thing, right? Like they're there because they have a goal that they're trying to achieve. And this is one of the steps along the way towards that goal.
Yep.
And for the cyber partisans, that is also the case. You know, they probably hack a lot more things than they necessarily need to, because they are less, they have less visibility and won't be able to do the same sort of laser targeting NSA will, and et cetera, et cetera. But they don't sort of hack for fun. Like it's not a thing that they're doing just because they've got like a free weekend and they kind of like want to mess around deface something, you know?
And I mean, in the intelligence cycle, there is a section on planning and direction. And usually, at least in Australia, there's this very formal process of coming up with intelligence collection priorities. And I imagine and certainly for NSA, they would be very specific things. So I kind of think that when your goal is to overthrow a regime, there's probably lots and lots of ways that you can get information that could potentially help that. And probably that portion of the intelligence cycle is less precise for the cyber partisans than it is for NSA.
Yeah, I think one of the other things to remember is, as I said, they're young, and also I don't know if there's ever been a regime overthrown by cyber before. So they don't exactly have a blueprint to follow.
Yeah.
They can't just look and be like, we will do exactly what, you know, like the cyber revolutionaries did in Cuba. You know, we will follow the books and theories laid out by Cyber Mao. You know, all of this, they're sort of not only figuring out how to do it as they go along, but figuring out what it is that they need to do.
Yep.
And so, yeah, like that is going to impact their targeting. They can't be like, okay, you know, we've accomplished steps, you know, 3 and 4 on the big list that everyone does. Let's see what we can do about, you know, getting onto 5 and 6.
So one of the interesting things is since the beginning of the invasion in Ukraine is that they've pivoted from just, I guess I'd call them hack and leak, to also disruptive operations. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I thought that this was absolutely fascinating, amazing, and also from a norms and policy point of view, quite scary. So one of the things that they did was prior to the invasion, this was in February, I believe, they hacked the Belarus railway and they installed ransomware to disrupt and disable it. And the ransom was for Lukashenko to bar Russian troops from using Belarus, which is kind of amazing. But, you know, why that's scary is also if you have a group using ransomware to impact critical national infrastructure and extort a government, and you don't do something about it, then that's sort of a norm that becomes acceptable and becomes very hard to say, well, what is the difference between Conti doing things because the FSB has asked them and cyber partisans doing things because, you know, they've decided to do it, like, but they're both using ransomware to achieve their ends.
I guess in this case, the Belarusian government would do something about it, right? My first thought is that it's up to individual states to deal with cyber badness in their own territory. So in a way, the rest of the world not doing anything is kind of not a problem from a norms point of view, because, hey, Belarus, it's your problem. You deal with it in the first place anyway.
Right, except the partisans are definitely based outside of Belarus. So now the issue is, okay, like I don't know where they are, but let's say hypothetically they're in France. Yep. So if France is allowing this to happen, then what logic does France have to complain about Russia allowing Conti to operate?
Right. Yep. I see where you're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. So it becomes this strange, like, well, you know, I'm absolutely not advocating that people should do something about the partisans. I'm in favor of their cause and everything. They need help. But it raises this fairly thorny issue of what responsibility does a state have to deal with non-state actors acting against another state. It's a thorny issue. And the Talon guys, like the guys who write the manual about cyber war, they don't have an answer. They actually sidestepped the question when they got asked about it. They said, well, you know, if it's internal to a state, then it's not an international law issue. Next question.
Right. Yeah. I imagine that most countries are just hoping they don't get asked to assist.
Yeah, exactly.
And then like perhaps play slowly if they do. We're very busy here.
Like what happens if Europol starts getting red notices? You know, Europol's going to go like, hey, you know, we've got limited resources. We have to pick and choose what we're going after. And we can't really follow up on that. I mean, I don't know if it's going to be Europol or whatever, but that's the sort of question that comes up.
Yeah. So one question I have is we've spoken about having a clear goal and we've spoken about learning by doing. Do you think there's anything else that has helped the partisans get better at what they're doing?
So I actually don't know. When I've spoken to them, what they've said is like, we learned online without going into details. So I, you know, and as someone who taught myself, you know, back when there are far fewer resources available, like I don't discount that as a path because I don't know what they did or what their skill levels are. Yeah, they must have just figured it out with YouTube videos and Udemy courses or something. I think what's worth taking away from this is that the West, in a lot of ways, undercounts the skill level of other nations. So like the Five Eyes knows that they are like the 800-pound gorilla. And so they don't think that there could be, you know, another operator close to them. When first of all, you look at the cyber partisans who went from web devs to shutting down the railway of a state and blocking Russian logistics for several hours, the better part of a day, right? Like, that is an impressive amount of tooling up. Like, now, to be fair, like a regular web dev can screw up things for, you know, an incredibly long time as well without having to do cyber.
One of the things I think about the Five Eyes agencies is that they're very, very good at things that a lot of other nations don't really care about. And what I mean by that is they're very, very good at being undetected and conducting operations at scale, but also at scale in a way that they don't get found out for a long time. So most of what people know about the Five Eyes comes from the, or think that they know about the Five Eyes operations comes from Snowden and WikiLeaks and also Vault 7. So they've operationally, they've done very, very well for a long time at not getting caught and not getting publicized. And I just think that some of the other nations don't care that much. And so maybe that's a case of the goals reflecting the way that they operate.
Absolutely. I think that this is one of the things that I don't know if it gets reflected in the literature very well. It's that there's a very, I don't want to say like Eurocentric or ethnocentric view. We have a way that we think about cyber. And so when we analyze someone else's cyber, we do a lot of mirror imaging because,
right, I mean, they're they're noisy.
Right. They're not us, essentially. Yep. Like they don't do what we do, therefore they're not as good as us. Whereas, you know, the metrics that they're using to evaluate themselves are more like, did we achieve the thing that we were trying to achieve? You know? And that could be very different. So for example, there's an excellent article right now on War in the Rocks about evaluating the Russian cyber operations in Ukraine from the perspective of how Russia understands cyber operations, right? Not from the view of the West, but how Russia does it. And Russia has this a different view where they view information operations and cyber operations as just, you know, operations within the information domain.
Yep.
They don't separate them. So when we're looking at, well, not we, because I don't do this, but like when there are Western analysts looking at this going like, they didn't turn off the lights. You know, they didn't disrupt the banking sector. You know, this isn't cyber war. What we're doing is we're doing this mirror imaging. Like we've invented, these people have invented a way that cyber war is supposed to look. Yeah. And if Russia doesn't do it, then Russia is not doing cyber war. You know, QED, like, reality is wrong. Reality is not following the theory, so reality is wrong. But, you know, clearly Russia was doing what they wanted to do, and they did it effectively as well, I think. So, yeah, like, there's very much the thing of, like, you have to understand them on their own terms, but also people can tool up really rapidly, and they can do it without, transfer of, I don't know, like, sanctions don't help. Like, you can't stop the transfer of cyber munitions in the way that you can for, like, rocket tubes.
Yep.
You know, like, laptops and internet access are sufficient to become a cyber power. If you've got the will and you've got the people, it's enough. You know, like, the people, ideas, hardware, in that order.
Yeah. I've said in the past that cyber power is bureaucracy, in that if you can harness hundreds or thousands of people working together to do those different functions of the intelligence cycle, that's what gets you true power. Anyway,
Grok, thanks very much for that discussion. I think that was great. And let's do it again.
Excellent. Absolutely. This is excellent stuff. Talk to you later, man.